This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. All is well.
Fantastic. Well, today we've got a couple of good questions. On one is the title of this show today is called "Is Knitting a Sexual Display?" And comes from a question from one of our listeners. And then a couple of questions about sexual inexperience and how that plays out in the dating market. Before we get to the questions, though, just published this Monday, so a couple of days ago, was a article in the journal Current Biology. And the name of the article is "Males with a Mother Living in Their Group Have Higher Paternity Success in Bonobos But Not Chimpanzees." So it turns out that bonobo mothers frequently, they will drag their sons into close proximity with menstruating females or estrous females. So they do a couple of other things that enables the sons to have higher paternity success. So in addition to dragging them to close proximity, they protect their sons' mating attempts from interference by other males. So I guess it's not even a wing man, it's a wing woman. They interfere in the mating attempts of other males.
Wing bitch.
And,
What was that? Wing bitch. Some tough old lady. Gonna stop somebody else from getting to the girl. It's hilarious.
and they also interfere, and this is interfere with the mating attempts of other males.
Yeah.
And they also form coalitions with their sons to help them acquire and maintain the high dominance rank.
Right.
And so, as it turns out, there was an Israeli article that published the same journal article, but the news article titled their piece, "Jewish Mother Gene Found in Bonobos." And the subtitle was, "You Think Your Mom Is Bad? Just Wait Till You Find the Lady Bonobos."
That is priceless. Oh, my God. All right. Yeah. So that's good.
It turns out that bonobo males with a mother living in the group at the time of conception, they were about three times more likely to sire offspring than males that did not. And this, they observed the difference between the bonobos and the chimpanzees. So male chimps actually who had a mother present when they tried to put on the moves were actually one and a quarter times less likely to sire offspring. And the primary author, who is Martin Serbeck, is the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology. He's hypothesizing that this is because females are actually subordinate to males in chimpanzee communities, unlike in bonobo communities where they're more level. So the other interesting thing was the team only saw that bonobo mothers helping sons, not the daughters.
Yeah.
So in the bonobo system, the daughters leave the community while the sons stay there.
Right.
And when the daughters leave, then they encounter a different kind of female support system, which is they form an alliance with the females who run the new home. So this is an interesting article, and I thought it fit well with our topic today.
Well, I think the interesting thing about this is that we start to see. I mean, it's entertaining as all get out, but we start to see that essentially that what living things are is they are often part of a gene team in certain animals, humans definitely being one of them. So they are able to keep track, you could call it that in quotes, of where their genes are located, and that they use their time and energy to aid and abet the genetic success of their genes, and no matter where they're located, if they're located inside their own body or they're located inside the body of close relatives. So the any event, we're going to find all kinds of twists and turns on this, and now people they're starting to wake up to understand that we all have intuited that, of course, we would help our brother or sister if they are injured or sick or need something. But we haven't been thinking along reproduction lines. So we haven't been thinking along that it's in our best interest to be seeing that our first degree relatives would be more successful in terms of mating. And I've said, and I was may not be correct, but I may be correct, that humans are the only species to meddle in the mating choices of their offspring. Now we're starting to see that here in the bonobos, they are involved in. They're not involved. It doesn't look like necessarily they're involved in the choices, but they're involved in influencing the success in the mating, which is fascinating. So it's not too far of a leap to the bonobos are highly relative to humans, just outrageously promiscuous. So it's going to be more of a numbers game. How many matings does a male get as opposed to who he mates with? Whereas in humans, choice and because there's so much paternal investment that goes into offspring, males have evolved very high discerning circuits for evaluating female mate value, which is very often not the case through most of the animal kingdom. So it would be unlikely that male bonobos have a lot of opinions or feelings about the differences between relative females. If she's fertile, she's fertile, and that's that. Let's see where I was going with this. I had a point to this thinking. The fact that choice of specific individuals actually makes an enormous difference in human long-term mating successes because of the huge investments that are involved in males making these choices. And also the females are making enormous investments. So they have always, throughout the history of the animal kingdom, they have been very choosy. They are the original the original fussy mating machine is a female, as they're designed by nature to look for sexy cues on the parts of males in different species in order to pick the sexiest males. Now, as we go forward with this, what we're going to see is a kind of what is probably unique. Maybe someone knows that it's not unique. Maybe somebody listening knows something that I haven't heard, but I believe that we are a unique species where the individual differences in the specimens is so important for both sexes, so much so that you also have such a big brain and gene tracking devices sitting inside the parents of an adult offspring that they're going to be super fussy and have very high, strong opinions and feelings and even action to interfere with the mating choices of their offspring. That is extraordinary, but now that we see this action on the part of the female bonobo chimp, we're seeing the outline of how it is that this could easily evolve. So very interesting, great study, and it's really great that it came from Israel.
Okay. My mother is far too pleasant to be the wing bitch, but Lord knows she's tried a few times.
Okay. All right. What do we got?
All right, Dr. Lyle. Well, our first question comes from before we get to the questions, I actually had a friend of mine who listens to the show here and there, and he tells me he heard somewhere that the anxiety of levels of kids today would put a 1950s kid in a mental hospital. And he wanted to know if there was any truth to that.
No.
All right, moving on.
That's totally ridiculous. You'll just see people just patting themselves on the back all over the place. There's a comedian that I've really liked, Bill Burr, and he talked about how sometime on Oprah, somebody was saying, "Gee, you know, being a mom, that's the hardest job in the world." And Burr said, "Really, girls, you got to be kidding me! Like, why are you patting yourself on the back? Being a mom, it's not the hardest job in the world. Try getting shot at as you get out of a boat, you know, storming the beaches of Normandy. Try digging coal, okay? There's a lot of hard jobs in the world. Being a mom is a challenging job and can be very challenging, obviously, and very worthwhile and rewarding and effort-filled and everything else. But the hardest job in the world? I don't think so." And so by the same notion, the notion that kids today, you know, have so much anxiety, they've just got it so much tougher in some fashion, is utterly ludicrous. And no, there's no truth in whoever made that statement was out.
Being a mother is the most difficult job on the planet. Oh yeah, all those mothers who die every year from black lung, from inhaling all that coal dust. The women are just constantly patting themselves on the.
Okay, we'll end it before
God,
he gets
to
some
you found it. That is really good. Yeah, we got to give you a raise. That's well done. All right.
All right.
Let's
well,
go
our
on.
Very first question. Yeah. Now that we've offended half our audience, now.
Yeah.
Okay, Dr. Lyle, on a recent episode, you said that the things we do in our free time are usually sexual displays. Well, I do like playing music. I play a couple of instruments. I guess that could be considered a sexual display, but I don't really perform. I just do it because I enjoy it, and I'm a woman. My biggest pastime, however, is knitting. My dating coach told me when I put photos of myself on my profile to have a headshot, a full body shot, and some pictures of me doing interesting things. I said, great, I'll have my friend take a picture of me knitting and also sitting in front of my spinning wheel. I was told that men are not interested in those things and not to use them on my profile. So is my dating coach wrong about knitting being a sexual display? Or are there other reasons we do things in our free time besides sexual displays? In a more primitive time, being able to knit would help the tribe stay clothed and warm. So it does have some value.
Sure. Yeah, the dating coach knows next to nothing, as we would expect. However, they're right about it's your face and figure that what's going to matter. And so whether you're in front of a spinning wheel or you're in front of a crowd with a microphone in front of you or have a violin or a guitar, none of it's going to make any difference. What's going to count is going to be your face and your figure. So the rest of it is kind of irrelevant. And if you happen to be interested in knitting, go ahead and put it on there. If we think it's a relatively accurate transmission or signal of the kind of person that you are and the kinds of things that you like to do. Now, it certainly there isn't. It's quite a sort of an interesting thing. Like men like this or men like that, as if we're one group with one list of things that we find interesting about other people. We have high correlation coefficients, but not perfect correlation coefficients with what we find physically attractive. However, what we find interesting about humans is extraordinarily varied. And so as a result, you know, you go ahead and take pictures that in some way may encapsulate who it is that you are inside. That's as good a decision as there is. You don't try to play to the broadest part of the market, for God's sake. That's ludicrous. Now, do we do things for other than sexual display reasons? Sure. There's two reasons why we do things. We do things for survival improvement, or we do things for reproductive improvement. So absolutely, you could be knitting to do something productive. You actually are essentially doing something useful. There's nothing about doing something useful that doesn't also make it a sexual display. So I can remember some, I don't know what ad it was. It was for like, I don't know, Aqua Belva or, I don't know, Fruit of the Loom. It showed a bunch of really hot guys with their shirts off, you know, on a construction site. And so, and all the women in a in an office building were gathering together at noon because that's when, oh, it was Pepsi. There was going to be a Pepsi break. And so then the guys, they gather together, and some of them are taking their shirt off to take a break to cool down while they open up a Pepsi. And then all the girls get weak in the knees watching this. So the construction site has behind it the, and the doing of the construction action is physically demanding. It's, you know, it's even unpleasant. It's hot. So it's showing toughness out there. Then of course it, you know, it takes muscles to move that stuff. It takes enough intelligence, to know how to put something together, to use any tool effectively. And also there's a coordinated effort and a coalition that's working together to get something done. And if your guy is out there and he's really handsome and strong and he's working hard and he's sweaty in the hot sun, then, but he's got some other guys around too, so he hasn't been kicked out of the group. He's not a solitary animal. These are all fitness indicators. So is he doing something useful and productive? Yes, he is. He's rearranging the atoms of the world in order to serve human needs. And in doing so, he's being paid to do it. So he's a member of a trading community. So, and that part of the utility of that trading community is things like health insurance, food, shelter, and dental floss. So there's there are survival needs that are being being met there, but as well as reproductive needs. So you can imagine that knitting a sweater, imagine a bunch of people getting together, and we find out that Sarah over there is not only pretty nice looking, but she also knitted, you know, this big blanket that somebody's using. Well, that just might catch some male's eye. It's like, oh, she's actually somebody that has the diligence and the coordination to actually produce something useful. Okay, so that what is survival and what is reproduction starts to get blurred there. And so that's why so that's how that works. The other thing is that the fact that she likes to play the guitar or make music, this is we're going to find that certain kinds of actions are going to be prototypical of the species for things that they like to do because they are in fact fitness indicators. So a lot of people like athletics because athletics winds up being a fitness indicator that's been used for, you know, a million years or longer in almost any species. It's been used for the females to try to discern the differences of gene quality of the males. So in this particular species, it's going to turn out that, as I stated earlier, with respect to parental fussiness of mating decisions, it's going to turn out that because there's such a high paternal investment in offspring, the males are also going to get super fussy about who they mate with. And as a result, they're going to be looking to females for their fitness indicators. And so the fitness indicators of a female aren't going to be just solely sex-typed, like how wide are your lips and whether or not you twirl your hair and toss your head, you know, in an attractive fashion. It's going to also be true that you probably want to be carrying the genes that like to do things that males need in order to be competitive, because you want to be passing on the dose of those things to your sons. So it wouldn't be surprising to find that females are sometimes interested in athletics. Now, it's interesting to me how little they're interested in athletics, but they are. And some of them are more interested than others. And what's actually also interesting is that they're interested in singing and they're interested in music. And so so it doesn't surprise me at all that a female who may not be thinking about displaying those things in terms of any kinds of a mate attraction process in her own life may carry the genes for performance and an enjoyment of singing and making music that would be then potentially passed on to her sons. And so she might find herself liking this and not have the dots even connect in her own life to anything that winds up being a sexual display. But there it sits. and it might be discovered by a suitor sometime. And in fact, she told us. Okay. So very often, things that people can have as quiet displays, they may not be that prominent for them, and they may not be thinking, boy, do I want to get on the balcony and show this fitness indicator. But they may simply be things that they like to do. And that's certainly what I find in my participation in sports. So when I'm playing basketball, I'm actually wanting to earn the esteem of the guys on the court. And part of that is probably survival instinct, that I want to be a well-regarded member of the pack and therefore get a share of the meat of any kills that we have and be protected reasonably in if I get caught in any crossfire with respect to a village warfare. So I want to be a member of good standing. But I also want them to think well of me so that when their sisters and daughters and mothers chit-chat, that I am seen as someone with athletic capability that is respected. And so in other words, it's a wider pseudo-esteem process that I'm seeking. And I'm not necessarily, this does not have to be conscious at all. The guys in the gym, I don't think, are conscious of this at all. It's an unconscious mechanism of enjoying a process that has been long associated in the species as a legitimate fitness indicator. So that's and males are going to, that's going to run hotter in males than it's going to run in females. And females, the things that's going to run hotter in females is going to be direct effort to try to make their own physical presentation more beautiful. Okay? That would make sense. So because more of their reproductive value sits on the outside. So that's how that's going to go down. I think that's a
fantastic
thorough explanation.
Yeah, Doctor, one thing I really appreciate about your advice with regards to this dating that we've talked about before in shows is, you know, why should this person hide the fact that they like knitting? If that's going to turn off a guy, why not get it out of the way instead of attract
sure.
a guy who doesn't like someone who knits and it's
right.
taking away the deception?
Yeah. We wanna place quite honest advertisements, and obviously there's a process by which we aren't completely open. The reason why we're not completely open is, it's kind of a foolish way to proceed in life, because other people could take advantage of information that we leak that's unnecessary for them to know. We don't necessarily want them to know our weaknesses. So there's a process of unfolding and displaying who it is that we are. But the more transparent in general, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In this person's case, do you think maybe they can over exaggerate to absurdity and like have a knitting wheel with like this ridiculously
yeah.
big blanket
or
whatever it is that you
with
can knit.
With a gray wig on and granny glasses. No,
yeah.
obviously, but we could have, in other words, we might have 5 photos, each of them showing somewhat different content area, but that might be one of them. And that is if it feels like that, in other words, what we're trying to do is we're trying to display the big 5 plus IQ. And so we need to think about, is this a, you know, knitting would be essentially, what would it, does it speak to me? It speaks to me a little bit of conscientiousness to some degree, possibly somewhat introverted, and possibly somewhat emotionally stable. So in other words, someone who's quiet, just does something repetitively, likes to complete tasks, et cetera. So that's what those things speak to me. And so those, to somebody, those things are positive attributes. To someone else, might take one look at that and says, hell no, every chance I get, we're going to Vegas. And anybody that wants to knit or would knit doesn't fit on my agenda. Fine. So the idea would be, we want our photography to, if it's going to convey anything at all, it's going to try to convey, you know, what we're trying to convey in the big 5 about who it is that we are.
Fascinating. All right, Dr. Lyra, next question. Dr. Lyle, I'm a dateless and kissless male virgin with severe social anxiety disorder mm-hmm. at the age of 25.
Yeah.
These are a litany of insecure questions rolled into one. How could a mm-hmm. socially, romantically, sexually inexperienced, competitively disadvantaged, and inept individual ever hope mm-hmm. to gain any form of success within the dating market? What would be the optimal way to ease myself into this scene without fumbling too hard and ruining my chances? Would I be rejected on this basis if I chose to disclose this information up front? Or would there be any way of concealing this at all? What type of people would be most compatible for an individual like me seeking to improve their social skills and maturity in the process? Agreeable types? Or am I a tarnished person for this, and have I effectively impaired any potential due to my stagnation?
Okay. We're gonna act like this is a real question, because perhaps it is. The one thing the person has is pretty high intelligence, and they've also got some real courage to be asking these things. And so they've got attributes that would be attractive on that score. Now, with all this anxiety, and so certain little comments were made, like, have I wrecked my chances, et cetera. Well, life is long. You got a lot of chances. And the sooner we learn how to manage these challenges, the better. So this is why God created Match.com. Okay. So this is if you actually had to go up and tap a girl on the shoulder in a library and grit your teeth, which is what I did when I was a young man, then this is very, very difficult to do.
Yeah, but did you have a wing bitch on your side? That's the question. Missing piece of the puzzle, Dr. Lyle.
Oh my God, I didn't have any such advantage. So the notion here is that you use something like a dating app like this, and that's a very sort of pair bond oriented, button down, non-racy app, so it would fit pretty well our young guy. I think if we were to look at the demographics on something like eHarmony, I think it's older people. It's one notch older, so maybe, I'm not sure, but Match is a little too old for our 25-year-old guy, but not too old. So there's going to be some button-down conservative young ladies on there probably, and that's exactly who it is that we're looking for. Now, the good news is that, you know, obviously you pay attention to little details. So you take good photography, you take direction from the website about how to write a profile. You know, don't write a book and don't write three lines. We're writing towards the big five is what we're trying to do. And the issue is here, you can't lose them all, and you won't. So you may lose almost all of them, but you're not going to lose them all. And the person considers themselves very disadvantaged in a multitude of ways. And that may be, but that's only relative to certain sectors of the competitive market. That this individual sits somewhere on the bell curve, and somewhere near them on the bell curve on either side of their location, there is a market. Okay. So that market, they may not be wild about that market, and they may indeed reach beyond that market, and they may get a great deal of rejection. That welcome to life of everybody that's, you know, beneath the 80th percentile. So that's fine. You can learn to live with that kind of rejection. That's not the kind of rejection of tapping somebody on the shoulder in the library. This is just writing an email, for God's sakes. All right. So you can write nice, simple emails. You read what the person says in their profile, and you react to that and speak to that. This person can write a letter to us quite articulately, so they can do this as well to prospects that are looking for companionship on the other side. And then what you have to do is, if you ever are successful, we need to be getting ready. And so we need to understand that, you know, you've basically got sort of an hour interview. If you're going to meet somebody for lunch, okay, I wouldn't do dinner right off the bat. That's probably in over your head. So, but I would meet somebody maybe even for quote coffee or lunch possibly. So you're going to try to make it a relatively intermediate level meeting. And then what you're going to do is you're going to prepare for this. So if you had a class where you had to give a speech and you had to, you know, this was your whole grade was going to be on the line for this class at the end of the quarter or the end of the semester, do you think you would practice? Do you think you would write the thing? Do you think you would go over it and over it and, you know, be editing it and then have your big sister look at the thing? Of course you would. And so then you would practice and you would practice again and you would practice again and you would stumble, okay? And then you would get better. And by the time you had practiced that speech, you know, 30 times, you'd be halfway decent at it. And that's exactly what an individual like this needs to do. So what you're doing is you're facing basically something that remotely looks like an hour conversation. And so your job is to see if you can get them talking for at least half of it. And with any luck, if you ask enough questions and you know how to ask those questions and you know what questions you're asking, you might be able to get them to talk for 40 minutes of it and you only got to talk for 20. So you're going to script this out and know what kind of questions you're going to ask. You're going to be anticipating what it is that they're going to say, and then you're going to be figuring out what additional questions you can ask after this. So you're a little bit like a young clinical psychologist that has no idea what to do with a client in the room, but you better start figuring it out, okay? And then you start realizing after a while, if you watch other people, that there's a scheme to it. Like, oh, you know, what are you, how are you doing today? What's going on? What sorts of, did you have any trouble finding the place? Okay. So, oh, good. Well, obviously they're there. You know, nobody's ever said to me, well, I'm here, aren't I? These are just friendly little, this is what we call a patter. Okay. So it's a friendly little set of innocuous interchanges that we use. And then we go from there to ask them the more in-depth questions about their life. No big deal. Like, oh, what do you do? Okay. And that's easy. And then we follow up from there. So we better kind of have in our memory bank a whole bunch of questions that we're going to ask. And then we're also going to know that they will reciprocate. So hopefully they're just as shy or nervous as we are. And so, which they probably are. And so in any rate, that what's going to happen is they're going to use a reciprocal process. They're just going to mirror what it is that we do. So they're going to turn right around and ask us questions about where we're from and what we do and what we like and what kind of music we like and, you know, what do you do on weekends and, you know, how do you like the people you work with and do you have any brothers or sisters and blah, blah, okay? So we're going to be ready. And for some of those questions, we're going to have little 30-second to 45-second little stories attached to it that tell a little goofy thing about ourselves. But it's a little bit funny and interesting. And you're like, well, how the hell do you do that? Answer, you practice it. You script it. You use your intelligence and you look at other, you know, you get help. And so what you want is you want to make sure that you walk in there armed with 10 little answers to those questions that you're very likely to get. And you're going to just roll this thing out and you're going to know what it is that you're going to say. And you know what? You're going to be halfway interesting. And that's all you need to do. You just need to survive it. So it's kind of interesting to note. Most of us just stumble our way through this with just barely enough social skill to survive. And then we live to fight another day. I can remember I was in the 11th grade at Wilson High School in Long Beach, and I was in it was like a poetry class, or I think, or semantics with a football coach of all things. And there was a couple athletes in there and that were pretty cool. I can't think of one of them. His name was Paul. Another one's name was Mark. They wore their Letterman's jackets and they were pretty cool, but it was kind of a female class because it was like semantics and poetry or something. So for some strange reason, there was like three of us guys in there, and then there was another guy that was like a hippie, And there's like 6-7 guys in there maybe, and about 20 women. And at some point, the prof said, or the, not the prof, it was Mr. Barnett said, well, you guys remember what it was like on your first date. And I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was 40 years ago. And I can remember this guy that was quite extroverted and cool named Paul, that was on the football team, really nice guy. He goes, oh, and he puts his hand over his eyes. And Mark Oberjerky, who is tall, handsome basketball player, also just looked down and shook his head side to side and just chuckled. Like both of them had bad first dates. Meanwhile, I remember my first date was terrible. Okay. It was just a disaster. So I thought it was very good. It was like my group therapy. It's like, oh, well, if these guys messed it up, I'm in perfectly good company. So the point is, for our questioner, you're going to mess it up. And as we all did, and maybe not some of us, so some of us are too cool. I'm sure Alan Goldhammer didn't mess up his first date. He was in charge all the time. Okay. But I did, okay, and my other friends did. And so join the club. And it's trial by fire. You get through it. I didn't prepare like this, though I did prepare carefully. You know, my car was clean, let me tell you that. And I knew where we were going, and I had like money in, not only in my wallet, but I had like $20 in my shoe just in case I lost my wallet. Plenty of gas in the car. It's like, you know, I was in pretty good shape for that date, all right? And I survived it. And so that's what you do. Your job is to survive. And on his other questions, I wouldn't disclose the fact that this is your first date. This is not information that person needs. You prepare, and they won't think that this is your first date. It'll never occur to them. The fact that you may be very anxious, that's just part of your personality. It's okay. We'll live with it. If you're so anxious that you can't even face it, go to your doc and get a beta blocker. And that just means knock down the anxiety. Don't get drunk. And finally, you're 25 years old. You're not too late at all. You're actually very young, and it's never too late to learn. I remind myself of this a lot. There's things that I don't know, and I have avoided, and I'm slightly embarrassed that I don't know. And I remind myself it's never too late to learn. I had a basketball coach in junior high named Andrew Logan, and we were a very good team. Alan was on that team. He was good, and we were a good team, and we were pretty confident. We were beating everybody by a lot. And one day, Mr. Logan takes the ball and starts to talk about situations, and says, "Do you know what the rule is?" And here we were, thought we were so smart. We listened to Chick Hearn call the Laker game since we were little kids. We knew everything there was to know about Jerry West. We thought we knew everything. And we didn't know anything. One situation after the next, he would say, and we didn't know. And he would say, it's never too late to learn. And I thought, boy, you know, I'm sure glad we're learning now, because I didn't know the rule. And I never forgot that. It's never too late to learn. If you're 25 years old and you haven't had a date, no problem. Prepare the best you can and grit your teeth on match.com, write 100 emails, and somebody out there is going to give you a yes. It might be 1 in 100, but you will probably get 1 in 100. And when you do, you may meet her instantly, and you may be completely uninterested, and she may be completely uninterested in you. And you grit your teeth, and you go through the process, and you ask her the questions, and you survive it, okay? And there will be an exhilarating feeling of your self-esteem when you get through this thing, like diving off the high dive to graduate from the Y swimming thing. It's like you did it. You didn't want to do it, but you did it. And the second one is a lot easier. And then the third one's a lot easier still. And by the 60th one, you're merely lousy. You're not a disaster, okay? So there's a course, a very reasonable learning curve with this, and to be reasonable. By the time you've gone on, you know, 15 first dates, you're going to be pretty good. And you're gonna understand people and the natural script of that process, and you will be, you know, you'll be on your way.
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle. I guess it's about time I go on my first date. So, you know, we'll see how this goes.
All right. What else do we have?
All right. Our next question is from the female's perspective, but slightly different. So, Dr. Lyle, I'm a 20-year-old female, and I recently had my first date with a guy I've been friends with for a couple of years. So I'm wondering if and when I should tell him that that was my first date. And in general, how much information about your relationship or sexual history should one reveal in the first few dates?
I wouldn't be revealing anything about that. That's not actually that useful and important information. And it may lead to them making some inferences that don't make any sense for them to be making. So we wouldn't want to we wouldn't necessarily want to be leading with any information like that. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to be pretty transparent about our personalities. That's different. And so we're going to reveal other things about ourselves, about things that we like, things that we don't like, things that we like to do with our time, what our hopes, dreams are, what we're planning, what our next goals are, et cetera. That's all legit. But specifically our dating history or sexual history, I don't see that's something that you need to do. Now, you could later, and if it's appropriate in any way, sometimes people will do that. And and that's fine, because it may be a method for a person showing something about themselves. Like, my ex-husband was a bastard, and my one before that was a bastard. I actually can remember a date I had with a young lady when we were young. And we went out, and we were at a place in very nice restaurant in Tiburon in the Bay Area in California, and was out on the patio. She was an attractive young lady, and I was, you know, very hopeful. At least I had gotten the date, and she sat there for 2 hours and just complained bitterly about her past relationships. So there you go. I got the information that I needed to make rational decisions at that point. You can say that you hate spiders. Yeah. Hate spiders. You love smoothies. And this young lady should definitely make sure she communicates her love for NBA basketball. Now that would be a valuable thing. All right. So yeah, don't bother revealing that specific history. Reveal other things about yourself. That makes the most sense in the early going.
And now for later on in the relationship, like I've never revealed those types of things in long-term relationships. I never saw a need to, but I always was curious because I do have friends who say that that's something that they talk about with their significant others, or at least people that they're dating early on in the process. But yeah, is there ever a time to reveal that sorts of thing?
These are sort of personality issues. So somebody like yourself who's crafty and defensive and manipulative, Nate, you would never do that. No, the truth is that these are personality issues. And so for myself, my very, very short and uninteresting dating career, I will talk about people that have been important to me or things that I've learned, because that's a way for me to have somebody understand me. Okay. So there, your relationships. So for example, it's a non-trivial thing to explain that not only were you married, but that your ex-wife and you are good friends and that you respect each other a lot. So that's speaking volumes. So that is a valuable transmission of information about you. And it's also in some ways a necessary one. So for myself, this says, okay, I've been married. Okay, so if I was in my 50s and had never been married, it's like, never? Why is that guy? that starts to possibly paint a picture that I wouldn't necessarily want them to be making. And so it would be, in other words, I wouldn't want to act like I'm unable and unwilling to be in a committed relationship. So so that's a perfectly good place to display that history and to talk a little bit about that relationship, and particularly highlighting the fact that it's very amicable. And so that's in other words, there's a time and place where our stories about who we are and who's been in our lives, it makes some sense to reveal those. I think that's more likely to be the case at, 40 or 50 than it is at 22. So anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, and what I've never had a problem revealing that kind of stuff, but when questions like, oh, how many sexual partners have you had, or stuff like that, is that just someone trying to figure out if someone's playing casual mating strategy versus pair bond strategy, or?
Yeah, I think that's in there, as well as impulsiveness, as well as sort of just sexual adventurousness in general. You know what I'm saying? So that's someone trying to cross-examine you specifically about your sexual personality. And your sexual personality could be a fairly important personality characteristic in any kind of mating, but particularly in long-term mating. So those are, those, to the extent that information might lead them to make inferences that would be likely to be incorrect about you, you may want to go opaque on those things. But in general, we want to be reasonably open about who we are, but we don't need to be real specific about it, about details. Yeah.
All right, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. Hopefully this explains this the questions in great detail. Mm-hmm. I love this. All right, Dr. Lyle, so we will end now, and we're looking forward to talk to you next week.
Outstanding. We'll do that. And thanks for having me, and we'll all see y'all soon.
All right. Take care. Happy day. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.